Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. On the other end of the phone line for this portion of the morning show, all the way from sunny South Florida, is Patrick Moran. And for many citizens of Kenosha, the name Patrick Moran is very, very familiar as a former mayor of Kenosha. And of course, many people would know Patrick Moran from his days as a school teacher in town. For a time, he owned a bookstore, and in other ways was an active, vibrant presence in the community. And Patrick Moran has penned a very interesting memoir about some of his early life, a book which he calls A Story of a Baby Boomer, 1946 to 1964. And it is a very intriguing look at his experience growing up in North Chicago, at a very turbulent time in our country's history. And eventually he enlists in the United States Marine Corps and tells about some of the experiences, particularly in the training phase, that, of course, punishing gauntlet that is part of becoming a member of the United States Marine Corps. And we're going to talk with Patrick Moran for the next few minutes about some of this and about his book, again, called A Story of a Baby Boomer. Patrick Moran, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, good morning to you, Greg.
It's good to be talking to you. You've, of course, been on the morning show before, but it's been many, many years. Before we start talking about your book and kind of the early phase of your life, I think a lot of our listeners would appreciate being caught up with you in terms of where you are now, what you're doing these days, what life is like for you.
Well, life is good. I'm very happy. We're outside of Miami, Florida, in a little town called Weston. It's between the Everglades and the Atlantic Ocean. We spend the winters down here, well, 2 months, January, February, and then we come back in the middle of March back up to Kenosha. And then in the summer, we've got a farm up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. We go up there for a couple of months. I love it in the summer, but I would not want to be up there in the winter.
Right. Remind our listeners and me of exactly the years that you served as Kenosha's mayor.
1988 to 1992.
And as I recall, some of your tenure as mayor overlapped with some of the biggest turbulence involving the auto plant here. And it must have really been something to be presiding over the city during events as tumultuous as those.
Well, it was a very turbulent time, as you know. Closed the manufacturing facility, kept the engine facility, and this was right before I took office that Chrysler announced that they were going to close the manufacturing facility in Kenosha.
I suppose when one signs on to be mayor in a city like Kenosha, you maybe think about the possibility that it's going to include some events like that, and yet probably going in, you probably had no full expectations that you were going to be riding that kind of a bronco through your time as mayor.
Well, you truly don't. I mean, it was certainly one of these crossroad epic times for Kenosha. I mean, the manufacturing industries, heavy metals in particular, and the automobile industry was a critical part of Kenosha's lives. 16,000 people were employed there in 1959 when the Simmons plant closed. And as late as the early 1970s, I want to say there was between 8,500 people that were employed making good wages at a wonderful, wonderful company.
Mm. So remind us of when your connection with the city of Kenosha began. I, for one, I guess, I don't know particularly why, but I kind of assumed all along that you'd always been from here. But, of course, reading your book, we learn otherwise, that, in fact, you grew up in North Chicago. When did you first come to Kenosha?
Well, when I got out of the Marine Corps in 1969, I had this desire to get into the aviation industry. So I went to talk to my high school counselor, former high school counselor, and he conveyed that there was an aviation program up in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and I wasn't quite sure where Kenosha was. I knew that one of the cities, Kenosha Racine, was famous for their Crindles, and the other one was famous for their automobiles. The other thing I knew about Wisconsin was they used to have a big, I believe it was a Blatt's beer sign, "Welcome to Wisconsin," when you crossed that state line on old U.S. 41 before they built I-94. And so when I talked to the consular, he conveyed to me that Kenosha Technical Institute at that time had the aviation management, a pilot program, and an airframe and power plant program. So I got into the car and moved up to Wisconsin and been happy ever since.
I remember one of the mentions you make of Wisconsin in your book is not only of that big Blatt's beer sign, but of seeing the sign for the Mars cheese shop and you wondering what in the world the planet Mars had to do with cheese.
Obviously, at that time, I didn't know Mario Ventura, wonderful man, great businessman. And I'm saying, Mars cheese castle, is the cheese made of green stuff? And I says, where's the Uranus Dairy Bar? Is that at the next corner?
Right. So we are primarily here to talk about your book called A Story of a Baby Boomer. First of all, at what point did you get the idea of wanting to write a book? And if you were going to write a book, that it would be a book about the first part of your life versus the latter part of your life. What did anything in particular serve as a catalyst for this project?
Well, I guess as you grow older, you become more nostalgic. And North Chicago has really gone through some major transitions, as many of the communities that were industrial and blue collar. And as I go down there and I go by the old homestead, it's not a Greek and an Italian neighborhood anymore. I mean, it's changed demographically and racially, and you just yearn for those moments of your childhood. And you look back fondly on some of those colorful characters and some of the episodes of your childhood, and it just gives you sort of a yearning to recapture those, and I thought I'd try to do it in print.
Hmm. So how did you go about doing this? First of all, had you ever done much writing before? If so, had you ever tried to do anything like write an entire book before? Was this really, for you, kind of uncharted territory?
Well, it was uncharted territory, as you could probably see as you read the book. I mean, I write the way I speak, so I'm certainly not a prose or English major. I'm a history teacher, and I love history, and I like telling stories and spinning tales, because some of my best experiences in the classroom to get students engaged is that they like stories. And if you could bring the period of history into the present or personalize it with an episode, the kids are captivated by that. And it's a good zinger, I call it, to get the kids interesting as you make the segue into your lesson for that day. So because of the nostalgia and because of the history and the yearning of my friends, I decided to give it a shot. When I tore my hamstring, I had plenty of time to sit down and outline the book and give it a try.
One interesting choice you make is that the photographs in the book are, by and large, not from your own life at all. They are photographs that sort of give us a look at the times. I mean, pictures of hippies and rioters and various major political figures and so on. But, you know, unlike the typical memoir, you know, we don't see a picture of Patrick Moran running in a track meet or Patrick Moran with a bunch of his family or whatever. I'm just wondering if that was a conscious decision on your part, and if so, what was behind it?
Right. Well, this particular story, of course, is my little piece of the world. It's a story of a baby boomer, which, of course, there were many, as you know. And what was going on in your little stage as these big episodes were going on the national and state stages. So I tried to go down into this little piece of my world and talk about the interactions of the baby boomers there and how we played a role on a big stage, but in a small way. So I guess that was my initial perspective of it.
I'm also wondering about whether or not you changed any names. And I ask that because some of the stories that you tell are potentially painful, once in a while, you know, kind of embarrassing or revelatory in some really intense ways. I mean, this is a really frank memoir, and I think that's the best way to write a memoir. But in some cases, when people do that, they'll change people's names. I'm just curious if you have done that in any case, or by and large, is this a full and clear history of your life, complete with the names of the people who figured in it?
Well, there are three individuals that I kept their original names. My great uncle, Patrick Moran, that fought for the Irish Republican Army. My cousin who, my outfit in Vietnam, I was in supply. We issued everything from bullets to body bags. We issued my cousin's body bag, Ellen T. Jensen. And the third person was Steve Maselli, one of my best friends in the old Italian Greek neighborhood. And there's an episode there when his cousin comes in from Italy and we get in a little mischief at that mattress factory.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Patrick Moran, and we're going to be talking about his memoir called A Story of a Baby Boomer. You write at one point, in writing about this neighborhood, this Italian-Greek neighborhood in which you grew up in North Chicago, I have often told my children that growing up in America in the 1950s and early 1960s was the very best time in the United States. What leads you to say that? What was it about that time which made it such a good time to grow up?
Well, in my case, it was the very best time because of this loving, extended Italian Catholic Irish family with cousins and aunts and uncles and the reinforcement, and everybody's in the same boat. It was a lower middle class blue collar neighborhood. But right on the other side of the tracks was Lake Forest, one of the most upscale affluent neighborhoods in America to this day. And you don't realize that you are of a lower socioeconomic strata when you're growing up, and you almost feel sorry for them because you think you live in paradise and in your little community with the smokestacks and the guys going to work with the lunch boxes and smelling the aromas of the Golitz candy factory that was on Morrow Avenue, or the penicillin that's being processed at Abbott Laboratory when the wind comes out of the northeast. These are all things that just made it great. I thought we lived in the best place on earth.
Tell us a little more about this interesting family and the mix of Italian and Irish roots, because that is really intriguing in and of itself, given the fact that in certain places like Boston particularly, Italians and the Irish often did not get along very well at all. I mean, some of the squabbles and quarrels are pretty legendary. Given that history, what was it like in your family with these two elements fused together?
Well, like they say, I have a T-shirt. It says Italian. No, it says Irish temper, Italian attitude. I'm Southern Mediterranean Irish, in other words, and it was somewhat unique. Up until that point, it was almost predetermined that if you were Italian Catholic, you would marry an Italian Catholic. God forbid if you went outside of that culture. Then, as life went on, and the big melting pot, and our church, Holy Family Church, was an amalgam of Irish and Italian primarily. They started to cross that line. After all, they're still Catholic, and you've got the monopoly on heaven. So that's when it started to change somewhat. But, you know, the Irish, like I talk about in the book, the whole social cultural focal point is the tavern. And I remember my grandmother after church, she would indulge in one highball a week, and it was after the high mass, and she would sit at the table furthest away from the bar, she and my aunt, and they would never approach the bar. And I could never understand that until I went to Ireland. And back in the, I was in the 70s, early 70s for the first time, they had what they called an antechamber, where there was a wall, and the children and the women had to sit on the left side or outside of the bar area. They weren't allowed to enter the bar back at that time.
Wow.
That was the end of the tradition. So the Irish, of course, the booze, the drink, I mean, that was one of the greatest things for them. That's where everything, the softball teams, the cribbage leagues, the bowling leagues. I mean, my dad was like a dog passing a fire hydrant. He couldn't pass a tavern, especially Dunnigan's Cafe, without going in there, God rest his soul, to have his drink and be with his buddies. Now, on the Italian side, it was a little different. It was, you'd have your wine with your pasta and with your meal, and the extended family would be there. But you really didn't, let's say, hammer the booze like the Irish side of the family did. It was sort of looked down upon. I mean, my grandfather made the wine in the basement, but yet they didn't really drink that. In my family, they didn't drink to excess. So that was one of the major differences. My grandmother Moran was going to be a nun. She applied to be, in 1912, a sister of the Precious Blood, a vow of chastity, silence, and poverty. She worked as a maid in Brooklyn. She never got the acceptance. She moves to Chicago. She marries my grandpa, and then she gets the acceptance to go into the nunnery. If you went into her bedroom on a Sunday when we'd go for the family meal after church, she had every conceivable saint ever canonized in the Catholic Church in picture form or statue form. There's even a holy water fountain next to the door. The only concession she made to my grandfather, who was involved politically, was a picture of FDR, John F. Kennedy, and Richard J. Daley. I was 8 years old before I realized that was not the Blessed Trinity in the Holy Roman Catholic Church.
It was the Blessed Trinity in that household in some respects, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely.
You write something real intriguing in this first chapter, actually towards the end of it, when you've spelled out already quite a lot of interesting facets about your family. You write at one point, growing up in an extended Italian family was both a blessing and a curse. In what way was it? I mean, actually, you've already touched on the way in which it was very much a blessing to be part of such a close-knit family. But in what way was it also a curse?
Well, as an Italian male, I'm half Italian and half Irish, but I grew up in the Italian neighborhood. My grandmother lived downstairs. My mother and her sister, one of her sisters, lived next door. My female cousins and male cousins were within a block radius. Males in the Italian context are treated like gods. I mean, you could do no wrong. And no matter what you do, it's unconditional love. I mean, they're behind you 100% of the way. And they spoil you to the point where you start to assume this is the proper behavior that a female treats a male, like this, in this manner. This is the way it should be. So once you venture out from the household and you go to school and you start to realize some of the wonderful, that's both a blessing and a curse, some of the wonderful things of the opposite sex, and you expect them to treat you like your extended Italian family. I mean, after all, I ran around with 12 guys in the neighborhood. We had wine with our pasta on Thursday nights. My aunts and my mom and my grandmother thought I could turn the water into wine. They treated me like Jesus. So when these other women aren't as receptive as you're growing up, you realize that if you don't want to be celibate and a priest all your life, you better change some of the rules in the playbook, because you're not going to be able to score, if you know what I mean, or have a good relationship with a lady friend if you're going to expect this type of treatment.
Mm. What was it like to be in this neighborhood with lots of Greek people? How did in general the Italians and the Greeks get along in your neighborhood, and what are some of your most potent memories of those Greek neighbors who were also an important part of your life?
Oh, they're wonderful, hardworking folk, boy, good business people. I remember going to school and my grandmother and some of her older friends being Roman Catholic. Of course, they looked upon Orthodox as not being treasonous, but not being able to attain the kingdom of heaven. The best that they could hope for would be limbo if they died, unless they switched over to the true faith of Jesus. which, of course, to them was the Roman Catholic Church. And I remember the nun telling us that, too, in Holy Family School. So when I would play with my Greek friends, I would say, wow, man, these guys don't have a chance. I really feel sorry for you. But the Greeks were hardworking, enterprising folk. Mr. Kowal, or Mr. Castellano, was a guy that had a fruit cart and a vegetable cart and bought a store and bought a tavern and bought some income property and worked hard. And he worked his way up on the top of the food chain out of lower middle class to upper middle class and then moved out of the neighborhood to a nicer neighborhood on the north side of Waukegan at that time. It was great. I remember I would go to church with him. At first, I was afraid to go, and my mother wouldn't allow me to go because it wasn't the Catholic Church. And, of course, Orthodox Easter, except for leap years, would be a week after ours. And I would go there, and it would be different but similar to the Catholic service. But there were a lot of these taboos and a lot of these, things that you're hammered in your head that, you know, you're the right way. And, yeah, they're nice people, but, you know, the way they believe is not the right way.
We get the sense from your book that you were growing up at a time when interaction between the races could was something that, of course, sometimes happened, but that there were certain neighborhoods and so on, and that there was a certain unspoken sense of demarcation between the races. What's your recollection of that in North Chicago?
Oh, yeah. Well, the line of demarcation was about four blocks west of my house, Lewis Avenue. And on the west side of Lewis was the African-American neighborhood, and then on the east side you had the Greek and the Italian neighborhood, and never the two shall meet. At our high school, at North Chicago High School, of course, it was an integrated school, and back in the early 60s when I attended, I was about 65-70% Caucasian and about 30% minority. So it was okay to, you know, really have interaction there on the sports teams and whatnot and at some of the social functions at school, but, you know, that's about it. But as time went on, I remember I was dating this one girl that had been going with my Greek buddy. She had one of the leading roles in a play that I was in, and we started to date, and as the year progressed, well, things sort of changed. She started to go out with the star of the basketball team that was about 6'8", 220 pounds, a great basketball player. But that was one of the first salt and pepper couples in my school. So one of the things that encouraged me to join the Marine Corps was the recruiters would come to the school at that time and give the address to the senior class boys in the fourth quarter of their senior year. And my girlfriend just dumped me for the star of the basketball team, who was an African-American guy, great guy. And I was put on notice by Western Illinois University that they wouldn't let me come in the fall session. I had to wait until second semester, and I had to work on some academic skills. And my dog died. I had 12 years, my Labrador Retriever, Tramp. I found him in the city dump. We named him Tramp. So I said, life can't get worse than this, and I knew we weren't going to join the Navy. And I turned to my buddies, and I said, I like that Marine Corps uniform, and we joined the Marine Corps 3 months before we graduated on the deferred enlistment program. And 1 week after we graduated, we went into the Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego, California.
Timing is everything, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. And I loved the way black people danced. And I used to dance, try to attempt to dance like a lot of my black friends. And Larry Gross taught me in 1961 how to do the slop. That was a dance. And I would go out there, and I felt that I was the white man's James Brown. I used to do the splits and everything. And everybody used to get a charge out of that at school and at some of the dances around town. And I even got my hair cut before the Beatle invasion, where they would square it off. I'd go to a barber shop with black barbers behind the Hiawatha Tavern, and they used to square off the back of my head and my hairline, and yeah, I really enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. Fun. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Patrick Moran, a former mayor of Kenosha, among many other things, but of course for a lot of you, that's where the name of Patrick Moran is most familiar. We're talking about the book which he has written that is a memoir of the early part of his life called The Story of a Baby Boomer. And before we get into some of your Marine Corps experience, we should talk about another fierce gauntlet, namely your experiences in Catholic school, particularly something called the Holy Family School, and a formidable sister there, Sister Mary Threat. And you tell us a few things about Sister Mary Threat. I think part of what makes this an intriguing part of the book is, of course, that you're talking about a time and place and an era that isn't really with us anymore. Although, of course, there are still plenty of parochial schools, and much of that tradition lives on. But the sort of ironclad atmosphere of discipline, which was part of those schools back in those days, that isn't really quite with us to quite the same extent. Just share with our listeners a little bit about what that experience was like for you and how you look back on it now.
It was culture shock, to say the least. I mean, you grew up with the fear of God in your heart. And like I said, the foundation was laid that, I mean, you were the true faith and everybody else was not. So the nuns at that time, they wore the habits from head to toe. The only thing you could see was their face. The black habit, the rosary coming down the left side, the black belt down the right side. And we had nuns by the names of Sister Etienne, Sister Johann, Sister Florentia, Sister Ermengarde, Sister Etienne, or Geron. And these nuns were the Sisters of Mercy. I call them the Sisters of the Divine Destruction. And Sister Florentia, the principal, I called Sister Mary Threat because she was she's pretty tough, tougher than any drill instructor. I shouldn't say tougher, but as tough as any drill instructor I would encounter in the Marine Corps in 1965. And one summer I was a bat boy for a pony league team in my town. My uncle coached, and I contracted ringworm. Everybody was changing hats and helmets and things. So they had to shave the back of my head, and then they give you the ultraviolet treatments, and they had to wear the stocking cap at night when you went to bed and put the medicine on. Well, when I went to school, I still had this ringworm, and I had to wear a hat in school. Well, of course, you have to take your hat off when you go into the school, but now they had to make an exception, and old Sister Mary Threat had the assembly of the school kids and wanted to reinforce that, yeah, you got to take your hat off, and the only reason Patrick has to keep his hat on is because he has a ringworm. And the way she said that, it was almost as though I was a leper, like I had leprosy. So then in the classroom, they put my desk in the back, in the corner, and they separated me. Oh, it had to be about 6, 7, 8 yards from the balance of the class where the desks were in rows. So as the school year would go on, that hat became part of my anatomy, and kids got used to it and were playing on the playground and everything, and things seemed to be not normal, but getting back somewhat to normal. And there was this one kid whose dad was the captain of the Navy base at Great Lakes. And he's a smart lad, and he was the teacher's pet that could do no wrong. And we played this stupid little game on the playground. We had this miniature football, and one fellow would go to the front of the group of boys about 15 yards to the front, and you'd throw it up in the air as high as you could, and the guys in the group would be jumping up trying to get the ball. Whoever got the ball from these gladiators would be the next one to go up to the seat of honor to throw the ball to the other group, or to the group. So one day, as I'm going up to get the ball and I had it in my hands, I feel somebody pounding me on my back with his fist and starts to hit me on the ringworm. I had my hat on, of course. So I turned around and I hit the guy right in the nose between the running lights. Busted his nose. His nose explodes with blood. And it's this John Paul Kent, the teacher's pet, the captain's son. So, of course, the patrol boys come, they break it up, they drag us in, and Sister Mary Threat is sitting there, and she says, "You are a bad lad. Look what you did to Mr. Kent, and you're going to be punished, and I'm keeping you in here for 2 weeks, no more recess, for 2 weeks. So then after the 2 weeks, I'm going back to the playground, and it was the Thursday before First Friday where we'd have a communion mass for the school. And as I left, this one other Navy kid by the name of Patrick Varinsky befriends me with a pretzel stick. Now, the moral of that story is beware of people bearing gifts. We go out to the playground. The next thing I know, a mob of boys surrounds me, and they start punching me and roughing me up. And then John Paul Kent comes into the middle of the ring after I'm, you know, softened up a little bit and gets a couple punches in. And then the patrol boys come to break it up. They haul us off to Sister Mary Threat's office. I remember looking at Sister Mary Threat behind the desk, and she looked somewhat like Don Corleone from Godfather Part 1. And she told me I deserved that beating. She set it up, this woman from God. And she said that if you tell anybody about this, the next time it'll be worse. In other words, she made me an offer I couldn't refuse. So that was about my last year in the Catholic school, and then I went to public school after that.
Mm. Among the really dramatic events that are part of what's otherwise in many ways a quite an idyllic and fun-filled childhood for you was the experience of right outside of where you lived, two different tragic accidents, one of which was far more tragic for your own family specifically. I wonder if you would just say a brief word about what I'm talking about. It had to be a harsh thing for a youngster like yourself and others in the neighborhood to experience and see something like this.
Right. Yeah, I always had this fear as a child that I would lose one of my parents or my siblings. I don't know what it was. I had this deep-seated fear of that. One hot summer day, my brother and I, who was five, 6 years my junior, were sitting in the front porch, and we heard the screeching tires, and we looked out the window, and we saw a 57 Chevy up on the side of the road and a mangled bicycle. And we ran down to the corner, and here's this little boy of about 7, 8, 9 years old lying in the middle of the road, bleeding profusely. Well, then, of course, the ambulance comes and picks up the child and puts him on the stretcher. And the next thing I know, the fireman is putting a sheet over the boy's head, but his body is still moving. And I couldn't understand why they would cover the boy's head if the body was moving, that the body had life. And then they put the kid on the into the ambulance. The mother comes, and of course, very filled with sorrow because her child was killed. And she's hugging the kid's tennis shoe that was strewn from his body when he was hit by the car because the impact was so great. And I remember vividly the neighbor coming out with a bucket of water and cleaning the blood off of the cement into the storm sewer. So then I turned to my brother and I said, "Now, when you cross the street, you got to stop and look both ways. You can't take anything for granted." Well, then, a year to the day, virtually, not the day, my brother's playing at my cousin's house in that area of the neighborhood, and the storm is kicking up. My mom's in the hospital. My little brother's up with another aunt in Milwaukee. And I go to get my brother at my cousin's house, and I look, and here's my brother lying in the same position in the street, bleeding profusely from the mouth, where that little boy a year later was killed. So my poor father just got home from work, and he still had his mill uniform on, and I went running down there saying Hail Marys and Our Fathers at 180 words a minute with gusts up to 220, and got my dad, and he came running down there, and I remember him kneeling in the middle of the street, man in despair and inconsolable. I mean, there was nothing you could do. I mean, it was beyond your power to change the reality. And the ambulance came, and they put him on there, and I remember the script, and I was waiting for the fireman to put the sheet over my brother's head, but they didn't. And what saved his life, according to the doctor at the emergency room, he was playing Army. He had his Army helmet on, even though he suffered a concussion. They said this might have helped in saving the kid's life. The blood from the mouth busted up teeth and bit his tongue and had a compound fracture of his leg and arm. But the kid did survive. But then after those two tragic accidents, the city finally put a four-way stop sign in at that intersection.
Hmm.
I guess that's your government working for you.
Wow. Well, we should probably leap ahead, although we're leaping past some really interesting stories that you end up telling in the book, including one that actually I don't think we can skip past without at least mentioning probably the moment in which you came closest to being killed, and it was in the car of a friend on a trip up into Wisconsin, of all things. It sounds like you were really lucky to survive this little incident. You want to just say a word about it?
Yeah. We're going to Union Grove, Wisconsin, to the drag races. There are four of us. The two in the back seat, myself and Larry, were supposed to hide in the trunk about four blocks before we got to the gate so we could get in without paying. So my buddy in this 1948 Plymouth is fishtailing on KR, which was a gravel road at that time. We skid right in front of a Fairlane 500. It looked like it was going to be a head-on, but we hit the ditch, we roll. As we're rolling, all I could think about was, oh, geez, my poor mother. I could visualize myself in the casket, and I could, you know, be like the wailing wall with my Italian aunts and grandmothers wailing at my casket, and I felt sorry for my mom. So then when the car landed on its side and the engine was revving up and the gasoline was spilling out, my one friend, who was hurt the worst, was able to go over and turn off the ignition, and we did get out of the car. And luckily for us, it was another day.
Mm. So easily. It could have ended very, very, very badly. You've already touched on the fact that your enlistment with the United States Marine Corps coincided with this sort of triple layering of disappointments and setbacks in your life. And so that opportunity presented itself just when you were just sort of reeling from all of this frustration and disappointment. And so that's what you ended up doing. You tell us about the fierce challenges that are part of at least initiation into the Marine Corps, and I'm sure for the other branches of the military it's comparable, but maybe the Marines are especially exacting. Talk for a moment about that opening process in which, as you sort of describe it, a person's individuality and connection to home gets sort of severed in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, well, you come there, and there are 8, 9 of us, I guess, on the plane from Chicago, and you land, and you're standing in, well, then you meet the sergeant, and you report to him at the airport, and this guy's not as nice as the recruiter. He tells you to get outside and stand there and wait for the truck to pick you up to take you to the recruit depot. So you get out there, and you know something's awry. It's not as nice as it was at the recruiting office. So as you're in front of the airport, you got these surfer dudes with their long hair flowing in their convertibles saying, you'll be sorry, because they know what you're there for, obviously. So when the truck pulls up, the reality starts to set in. A Marine with blue trousers with the red stripes, the khaki shirt, the white barracks cover with a swagger stick. It was almost like Jack Webb from the DI comes out of the truck. And he tells you, in not the nicest way, expletives deleted, to get into the back of the truck, and I'll give you 3 seconds. So, unfortunately for my friend, there wasn't enough room for an extra body. He had to sit between this. He wasn't a drill instructor. He was a receiving barracks non-commissioned officer and the truck driver. So as you're driving, you're saying, geez, maybe I made a mistake. And as you enter the gate, I said, this isn't like Great Lakes. I know what it's like in North Chicago from the outside of a military base looking in, but now I'm going to find out what it's like for a military guy from the inside looking out. And as you pull up, go ahead.
I was going to say the part of this process that especially resonated with me, or I just can't sort of forget the image of this first huge mass shower that you and your fellow recruits had to take together and what that represented in terms of what they told you to do.
Oh, Lord. I mean, you know, you go, you're standing on the footprints at a 45-degree angle, and he's telling you how you could get in trouble, and he's not very nice about it. And then when you get to the shower after the haircut, and you go to this one room before the shower, and you have to strip down jewelry, everything, you put in a box, you send it home, you're butt naked with about, oh, 2-3 dozen strangers, and then you march into this open shower bay with a number of faucets, and you're given this, it's like lava soap. It was a very coarse soap. And we had like a minute to take our first Marine Corps shower. Well, you're bald, you're looking funny, you're butt naked in front of all these strangers. So you wash and you rinse and you get out, and then they issue your first Marine Corps uniform. And at the first stage of training, it's not sharp and it's not pristine like a lot of the fellas that are at the last phase of training. You have the baggy green utility pants. You've got black tennis shoes, a yellow Marine Corps sweatshirt. And the hat doesn't fit too well. And your ears are catching the hat, the cover. And by the time you get to bed in the receiving barracks and they turn off the lights, the only thing you could think of is what in the hell was I ever thinking about by joining the Marine Corps? And all you could think about is, I've got 4 more years of this stuff. It's like going through high school again. It's going to be an eternity.
Right. And, of course, as you're taking that shower, you tell us the corporal barks that you have 60 seconds to scrub the civilian scum off of your bodies. And of course, that whole process is kind of encapsulated in those few words and for somebody like you, where home and family and all of those connections had meant a lot to you, this is probably a part of this experience that you just hadn't counted on.
Oh, heavens no. And the privacy that you take for granted, where you go to the washroom, you close the door, you go to the refrigerator, you get a snack, you're in the comfort of your private bedroom. Well, now you're sleeping with 65 guys in an opened squad bay.
Mm. Tell our listeners where, first of all, we should say that you make it through, although you tell us about the tension of having to pass the swimming test and pass the rifle test and this and that, and the merciless treatment that was given to those that didn't pass. And, I mean, that was just a nightmare to worry about, but you were successful all the way through. Ultimately, where you ended up being assigned was something of a surprise for you. In a sense, you were, I forget what your phrase was, something like at the rear with the gear or something like that. Tell our listeners about that deployment.
Well, the Marine Corps, what makes it different than other branches, all Marines, whether you're going to ultimately be a cook or a truck driver, in my case, a supplyman, a warehouseman, you go through infantry training, and you're an infantryman first. So you qualify with the rifle, you go through the infantry training, because if something happens and they have to replace a body in the infantry, they could go knowingly that they, the Marine Corps, and take a cook and put him in a line outfit, and he'll know what he's doing. So the Marine Corps always holds the rifleman in high esteem, which they should. And at the end of the training, they give you your military occupational specialty. And mine was in the rear with the gear, 35th 51. Well, first, being gung-ho after the boot camp and then, of course, the infantry training, you feel that, wow, man, I thought I was supposed to be an infantryman, a grunt. I should be out there with the guys. I'm going to be with the rear with the gear. So traditionally, the thoughts are going through your head that maybe I should really sign up for another extra year and infantry guaranteed and go to a front line. And I had a couple of buddies that had done that when we were overseas. I didn't. although I was in Vietnam. I mean, I was in, again, the rear with the gear at Da Nang. But that sort of haunts you for a while. You always think that maybe I'm not doing all that I should by not being out there on the front lines with my fellow Marines.
Mm. Well, ultimately, you end up being assigned to Washington, D.C. itself, where you end up being a active participant in a number of important ceremonies and occasions. What do you end up doing during that time in Washington, D.C., and what? How powerful an experience for it was it?
Oh, it was wonderful. I when I came back from Vietnam, they sent me to Camp Lejeune, and they sent me to a recon outfit. Now, recon in the Marine Corps is the equivalent of a Navy SEAL. The reason they sent me there, and you're out on Onslow Beach, which is the most remote place at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina, is because I had a secondary military occupational specialty of, as administrative clerk, and they wanted me to run the office for these recons. And I said, oh, my God, man, this is going to be crazy. And they're going to send me to jump school as a clerk, even though I'm not out with these guys jumping out of airplanes and doing the scuba stuff. So then when they had these special orders to interview to go to the Marine Barracks 8th and I, Washington, D.C., for the ceremonial guard, I jumped at the opportunity to get the interview. Now, you have to be 6 feet tall, minimum. And typically, they would take Marines right out of basic training because they're so disciplined. Well, the new commandant of the Marine Corps wanted an all-veterans post. He wanted guys that had served in Vietnam to now be Marines in the ceremonial guard in Washington. So I was one of the first that they selected. So some of the details would be the funeral of President Dwight David Eisenhower. I was in the court on there on Pennsylvania Avenue. The assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy. I was in his funeral procession. Special parade for Chesty Puller. He was the most decorated Marine in the history of the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps mascot, the Bulldog, is called Chesty in his honor because Chesty, who started as a private, was in the Marine Corps for 30-some years, 35 years, made it up to a three-star general. So I got to meet General Puller. We're in a parade for him. Richard Nixon's inauguration. My commanding officer at that time was Charles Robb, who was dating LBJ's daughter, Linda Johnson. He would become engaged. The father-in-law, the president, would take him and send him from Washington to Vietnam to be a company commander of a Marine Corps rifle company. Maybe he was trying to tell his daughter something. But he would survive and come back and run for governor of Virginia and then U.S. senator and serve. A lot of details for funerals at Arlington National Cemetery for fallen Marines. A lot of details at the White House for different ceremonies. So and the one thing that was very, very, very tragic, when Dr. King was assassinated, our barracks was right in the middle of town, 8 blocks from the Capitol building in southeast Washington, D.C. So you have businesses and apartments and homes all around the barracks, this 4-block area. So our original duty was to protect the Capitol because they built the barracks after the war in 1812 to protect the Capitol from foreign invasion or domestic unrest. We were called out during the King riots to help quell with the police department the rioters in Washington, in which 13 people were killed during the riots and countless numbers were injured and hurt and millions of dollars in property damage. And it was just incomprehensible that you're in this country. I mean, just looking at the chaos at that time.
Mm. Well, it, of course, was just one of many memorable experiences which you had growing up and ultimately to this period through the Marine Corps, and ultimately sets you up for a very interesting life which follows thereafter. All of these events and many, many more are told in this memoir called A Story of a Baby Boomer. It can be ordered through AmazonBooks.com, and the author, Patrick Moran. Patrick Moran, it's been great to reconnect with you, and I certainly enjoyed this conversation very, very much. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Always a pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an author by the name of Dana Casperson, whose book about conflict resolution is called Changing the Conversation. You'll hear that interview on tomorrow's morning show. And on Friday, the first of a two-part interview, which I did with an entertainer by the name of Bill